And now we shift to our final discussion on Roman Catholicism of the 17th and 18th century, looking at Catholic mysticism and Catholic missions tonight. Before next week, we will turn and do a lecture on Eastern Orthodoxy and all the developments happening there during this period as well. So I want to begin our lecture tonight by looking at what we call Quietism and the Catholic mystics. Quietism and the Catholic mystics. The originator of Quietism was a Spanish priest named Miguel de Molinos. Now, Molinos was a student of the Jesuits, and after being ordained as a priest, he became an admired preacher, one of probably the few but better preachers of the Jesuits. Now, if you know anything about the Jesuits, think of people like Loyola, who were very always caught up in this kind of view of mysticism. It's all about the spiritual life, very inward focused. And Molinos very much carried that forward. But unlike those, he was very much into preaching as well. And so he had a great public ministry as well, rather than just this kind of pietistic and mystical ministry. He moved to Rome in 1663, and he became a father confessor, where many notable cardinals made up his clientele. Now, obviously, Molinos became, he had a little bit of leverage because he was the main confessor for all of the leading cardinals. And so he knew all of the dirt on the cardinals, and so that kind of helped push him along in his career and gave him a little bit of leverage. And beyond that, he actually became very influential among the female aristocracy there. And in 1675, he published two of his most important treaties. These two works were titled The Brief Tract on Frequent Communion, and the most important of all of his treaties, which kind of brought about the development of Quietism, was this document, this treatise known as The Spiritual Guide. And you can find it on PDF format. You can look it up and read it today. It's actually still very influential. And we'll see how influential it was on actually some Protestants as well. He drew on the 16th century Spanish mystics, people like Teresa of Avila and John the Cross, and he pressed far beyond the 16th century mystics, went much more farther than they did. Molinos elaborated a vision of the Christian life, which many found very enthralling, and you'll see why that is. At the heart of Molinos' spirituality lay the rejection of all human effort. He believed that any human action towards God was sinful, whether good or bad. Anything that you ever try to do as a work towards God was not only wrong, it was sinful, it was bad, it was evil to try and make any effort towards God. Spiritual perfection required total passivity in God's presence and the annihilation of the human will. So whereas many of the Protestants, even the Jansenists, who were more Calvinistic, we would say, believed that the will needed to be freed from the bondage of sin, what Molinos taught was that the will needed to be totally annihilated. The human will needed to be absolutely destroyed by God. And this state of annihilation, Molinos termed as mystic death. In order to be spiritually perfect in this life, you needed to undergo the mystic death and have God totally annihilate the human will. But how did one achieve this mystic death? He taught that by a process of mental prayer, which discarded all meditation and all distinct acts of the will, very different from other forms of mysticism. Instead, in order to experience this annihilation, you needed to simply rest passively before God. Notice the name Quietism. Just literally sit quietly. That's the only thing righteous to ever do, is just to sit quietly. Don't think about God. Don't meditate about God. Don't do anything. Just sit quietly and let God do the work. That's Molinos' idea. And this mystic death brought about what he called the perfect state, where a person would no longer care even about his or her salvation, heaven or hell. All external acts were redundant. And now, because of that, sin was impossible. If you just sit quietly, you can't sin. So you become perfect. And while you're just sitting quietly doing nothing, God is destroying your will. And ultimately, after enough time of this sitting passively, the will is completely annihilated. And from that point forward, you have now experienced mystic death. Now, Satan might force the perfect soul to do things that would be sinful in the imperfect. But they could never be truly sins, according to Molinos, in those whose will had been annihilated. So let me explain what he meant by that. If you've experienced the mystic death, according to Molinos, the will has been destroyed. And though you may do something that used to be sinful in your imperfect state, it can't be sinful anymore because it wasn't an act of the will. The will has been destroyed. So he's justified antinomianism by basically saying, well, I don't have a will anymore. It's just Satan making me do it, but my soul has reached a perfect state. So though my external body is doing evil things, my soul has reached a place of perfection. It's almost very Gnostic in a way. My body, it can do evil, but my soul has reached the state of perfection. And so therefore, even though my body may be sinful, I've experienced mystic death, and so I'm no longer sinful because my soul isn't sinning. Molinos even said that it was positively harmful to resist temptation. It was sinful to even try to resist temptation in your perfect state, since resistance was an act. And human acts were improper in the spiritual sphere. And so this is highly Gnostic in a lot of ways. He's really created a dualistic sphere. And you can see where now Molinos has extended far beyond Loyola, Teresa of Avila, John the Cross, and all the other Catholic mystics of the 16th century. He has now pushed far into an area that is almost a proto-Gnosticism, mixed with this mysticism in many ways. Now at this point, Molinos' quietism was actually extremely fashionable. And the reason why is because the Inquisition was being led by the Jesuits. And so he had some protection, not only because he was the father confessor for most of the cardinals, but secondly, because the Jesuits controlled the Inquisition. And because he was a Jesuit, he had protection where many other groups during this period would have been totally wiped out by the Inquisition. However, within a decade, the tides of opinion were soon turned against the Spanish priest, and some of his religious superiors were hearing from some of Molinos' disciples and were putting a spin on his teaching, which allowed them to justify sexually dubious conduct. Shocking, right? Like, it's shocking. This is eventually going to happen. In many ways, this is what began to happen. Many of his disciples began telling many of the women, which during this time in Paris and in France, had a huge class of female aristocrats. It was a huge aristocratic party that was led primarily by noble females during this period. And a lot of these Molinos kind of led priests and these quietist priests would justify many we would consider perverse acts with these ladies by saying, your soul can't be touched anymore. It's faced mystic death. And so what you do with your body is irrelevant. It's no longer sin. How could their actions be wrong if their wills had been destroyed by the mystic death? That was the justification. Soon there was talk that Molinos and his female disciples were having improper relationships. And along with this was a growing sense that the quietist movement was becoming more and more anti-authority. The Catholic Church finally began to see, yeah, this is kind of a problem because these guys are saying, who needs obedience? Not only is obedience, like, not needed, it's actually sinful, Molinos is teaching, because it's acting towards God. Now, when you're trying to talk about, you know, being surrendering to the authority of the church and things like that, you need people who will stay somewhat in line. And that was getting more and more out of hand. So in consequence, Molinos was finally arrested by the Inquisition in 1686, along with many of his disciples, some of which confessed to the immoral conduct that they had been accused of. And in the latter part of 1687, a papal bull known as Celestus Pastor condemned 68 propositions of Molinos' teaching, and all of his writings were placed on the list of forbidden books. And he spent the rest of his life, 9 years, in prison. And that would lead to his most famous disciple and probably one of the most well-known Catholic mystics, a lady by the name of Madame Guyon. Madame Guyon. Quietism gained a new lease of life in France through one of Christianity's most famous and controversial feminine mystics. Guyon was always considered a strange child. She even was said as a teenager to have claimed many supernatural visions, even as early as a small child. And so pretty much her whole life was one where she claimed these kind of supernatural visions and acts and things like that. In 1664, at the age of 16, Guyon married her cousin, Jacques Guyon, who was 22 years her senior. And the day after the wedding, Guyon was not very happy. She was actually despised the decision that she had made in getting married and rather chose that she wished she would have been a nun. And for her sake, that would ultimately work out well for her. During her marriage, she claimed that she began having intense spiritual experiences, during one of which Jesus supposedly appeared to her and put an invisible ring of mystical marriage on her finger, claiming her for himself. Now, you can imagine, Jesus already has like the church as his bride, but nevertheless, Madame Guyon believed that he had came and wed her to himself in this kind of mystical marriage. And in many ways, many nuns in convents today would say that they've done the same thing as well. They have married themselves to Christ, that Christ is their husband in that sense. When her husband died in 1676, Guyon was now 28, and she used her newfound liberty to become a sort of freelance instructor into the new true Christian life. So she kind of becomes this kind of like traveling instructor, teacher into what the true Christian life looks like. She was extremely eloquent in her oratory skills, one of the best speakers of the day, and few could resist her torrent of editing words. Now, while previously married, she had already met the man who would pretty much be considered her soulmate. They would never marry, but they were always had this real tight-knit relationship, and she always spoke extremely highly of this man. And he was a priest and a disciple of Molinos named Francois Lacombe. Now, Lacombe was a highly emotional and impulsive personality, but he lacked really any intellectual clarity. It sounds like some political leaders I know. Very impulsive, very just, let's just fly by the seat of our pants, but he really didn't have a lot of intellect, wasn't very bright, and that's kind of where Guyon stepped in and kind of helped him along. Guyon found the priest fascinating and came and placed herself under his spiritual direction. Guyon claimed that Lacombe could cure one of her headaches with a single touch. And so you can see this kind of mystic concepts and ideas that are happening there. The closeness of the relationship was soon a big topic in many rumors, shocking. Gossip coming along with these ideas. And later on, Guyon, under duress when she was being tried, we'll see a little bit later, confessed to exchanging what she called innocent kisses with the priest, but nothing more. So they kissed a little, they smooched a little, but nothing further, she said. Through Lacombe and Guyon, quietism now began flowing into the most respectable religious circles in France. And this is not shocking. I mean, here is this idea that is talking about a perfected soul that also allows people to live and fulfill the flesh's desires. And so when you're talking about the noble class, this is something that fits right in with them. They get to kind of have their cake and eat it too in many ways. The two spent a five-year trek traveling throughout France and spreading the teachings of Molinos. The prominent female aristocracy in Paris were overjoyed by this new mystical movement, especially with a female now heading it up in leadership. Guyon summed up her teaching and her treatise, a short and easy method of prayer, which proved very popular very quickly. Guyon was a little bit smarter than Molinos, and she had taught a toned-down version of quietism, leaving out the teaching that Satan could attempt the annihilated will to sin. And so she left out that part about this idea that Satan can tempt you and lead you into sin, but you can still, that's okay, that can happen. She left that out. However, She did teach that annihilated wills could perform acts that the imperfect acts would be committing sin in performing. So if you have not experienced the mystic death and you do it, well, then you're sinning. If you have experienced the mystic death and do it, you're okay. You're safe. Your soul has been perfected. The celebrity status of Guyon disturbed his archbishop, who was far from impressed by the apostles of quietism or her soulmate priest. And immediately after Malinas' teachings were condemned by the church, he immediately had Father Lacombe arrested, who would spend the next 30 years of his life locked away, ultimately dying in an insane asylum, which was becoming very popular in France during this period. The asylums were becoming more and more of use during this time. Especially as more and more the rise of empiricism increases, the ideas of attributing things like schizophrenia and lunacy to demonic spirits is becoming more and more, I guess, a facade. It's getting kind of pushed to the side, whereas now this idea of real mental health and psychological issues is becoming more and more an idea and being pushed. And so the rise of these asylums are beginning there in France. Guyon was also arrested and confined to a convent. However, she was extremely fortunate in that she had a very prominent governess of Paris who helped Guyon gain her freedom. She went on to teach at a girls' school in Saint-Cyr that Madame Guyon met her second great spiritual companion, a guy who's very important to our story, a man by the name of Francois Fenelon. Now, Archbishop Fenelon, of all the Roman Catholics of the period that we've been discussing, he is by far the most complex and captivating of all the personalities. He was, by all accounts, a remarkable man. He was considered charming, had a commanding presence. He was handsome, an eloquent preacher with a brilliant intellect, and he found expressions in many notable works of philosophy and theology, probably the greatest mystic philosopher and theologian of the 17th and 18th century. He was also very spiritually sensitive, and he was racked with inner anguish over sins and doubts. So a good example, like to try and compare Fenelon with, as far as it pertains to this kind of inner anguish, would be Luther. Luther was one who constantly struggled with depression and an inner anguish over his own sinfulness. And Fenelon very much fell in line with that. He wrote, "I cannot explain my inner self. It escapes me, and it appears to be forever chaining. I have no idea who I am." And this is just talking about he has no understanding of why he continues to sin, why he's constantly fighting these battles. It reminds me almost of the sinful man in Romans 7, right? Even when I do what I don't want to do, I don't understand why. I can't stop doing it. I don't know where this wretchedness comes from. One of Fenelon's first jobs in the priesthood was to serve as a teacher in an institute whose primary purpose was to teach catechism to now newly Catholic converts from Protestantism. So he went through, and his whole goal was to try and revert all of these Protestants' thinkings of justification by faith and stuff like that to a more Catholic dogma pertaining to those things. He served as a missionary and to convert French Huguenots, and unlike many of his contemporaries, was one of the only missionaries during this period who was actually against forced conversion. Many believe that you make people convert by the sword, and Fenelon was against that. And so in his mission field, he did something that no other missionary did during this time, and that was he forced all French troops out of the areas that he was doing missionary work. He did not want any kind of conversion being brought about by force. He wrote, "Conviction is the only true conversion." After this time as a missionary, he was assigned to teach at Saint-Cyr, where in 1688 he made the acquaintance of Madame Guyon, and he was immediately impressed by her piety and quietist teachings. They developed a deeply emotional but physically chaste relationship. In other words, he remained in the friend zone the rest of his life. Although she was only 3 years his senior, Fenelon considered Guyon his spiritual mother, and she sometimes even referred to him as her baby. So it would have been weird if it had been anything more than emotional at this time. Nevertheless, Fenelon tried to correct some of the more unbalanced dimensions of Guyon's spirituality which under his influence was refined into something called semi-quietism. So Fenelon comes in. He's much more an intellect, much more a theologian and a philosopher. And he realizes some of the issues in Guyon spirituality. He balances it out in many ways and kind of gives it this kind of semi-quietistic teaching. Nevertheless, many traditional-minded French Catholics still found this quietism as distasteful, especially its somewhat erotic language when referring to Jesus, talking about making spiritual nuptials enjoyed by Jesus and the perfect soul. And so, let's just say the quietists were very fond of the Song of Solomon. They really liked that book, and there's obviously they loved that kind of erotic language of between the marriage of the bridegroom and the bride. Many young women were shocked when quietist priests would teach them these doctrines, finding their words unbecoming of priests because of speaking in this very erotic language of Song of Solomon and other things like that, even going much further than that. Which some, when you read Song of Solomon, you go, man, how do you go any further than that? But from 1689 to 1694, Fenelon and Guyon experienced a sort of spiritual honeymoon when under the eye of the governess who had brought freedom to Guyon, they were able to worship freely and attract a very tight-knit group of disciples. However, in 1694, this period ended when an extreme form of quietism began developing right under the nose of the two leaders. One of the young ladies in the school that Guyon was teaching at began to teach that prayer and good works were not necessary in the true, perfect Christian life. Now, some of the quietists didn't have issues with this, but many of the traditional Catholics did. How in the world could you say that prayer and good works do have no part in the perfect Christian life? When this came to the attention of the governess who had protected Guyon, she was extremely upset about this extremist view and ultimately entrusted a full-fledged investigation to be launched on Guyon by France's greatest preacher during this period, a man by the name of Jacques Benin Bossuet. Bossuet read Guyon's works very carefully. He interviewed her several times, and during this process, Bossuet unfortunately became very convinced of one truth. He believed that Madame Guyon was mentally disturbed. That was his ultimate finding. Guyon sensed his hostility and asked for two new judges to be added in the investigation. Now, Bossuet was ultimately saying, you know, we shouldn't condemn her as a heretic. We should just send her to the insane asylum because she's just mad. So he wanted to spare her life. He said, she's not a heretic. She just really messed up in the head. And that was Bossuet's concept. Now, Fenelon had been made an archbishop during this time. And when he heard of Guyon being put on trial, he met in 1695 and asked to be put on the tribunal as an archbishop in hopes of being able to try and protect Guyon from any major heretical findings. At the tribunal, 34 of Guyon's teachings were condemned, and though Fenelon tried to defend there and try to tone it down a bit, ultimately it still led to her arresting. She was locked away from 1698 to 1703, when she finally submitted to the church's condemnation of her teachings, where she would be released because of her recanting all of her teachings and submitting to the church's authority. She was allowed to be released, and she spent the rest of her life mostly writing poetry. And perhaps her poetry was more influential than any of her teachings had been. When Guyon died in 1717, her influence through her writings passed out of the Roman Catholic Church and into the Protestant world, where her brand of quietist mysticism gained many new admirers, including the Huguenot preacher Pierre Poiret, and her Molinist teaching was also influential on the pietists like Hermann Frank and Spinner. We looked at the German pietist already, and it was very influential on one very important English evangelist, a man by the name of John Wesley. John Wesley was very influenced by the quietist, by Molinos and Madame Guyon. There was another, he actually took Molinos' spiritual guide and translated it into English. That's how influential he was on Wesley. There was one other person that was very influential, a Calvinist poet and hymn writer named William Cowper. You may know the one hymn, "There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins, and every sinner cleansed beneath that flood has cleansed their guilty stains," or something like that. But it's called, "There is a fountain filled with blood." And he wrote that hymn, and he was very influenced by Molinos and the Quietist. Now, there was a clash of giants after Guyon's kind of recanting of her views and going off kind of into exile to write poetry. And that was between Fenelon and Bossuet. Now, these two were kind of the theological giants of their day. Bossuet, obviously, reflecting traditional Catholicism, and Fenelon reflecting this kind of quietist mysticism. And there's a picture of Bossuet for you. The condemnation and imprisonment of Guyon did not end the quietist controversy in France, as it continued in the shop of conflict between Fenelon and Bossuet. Now, this was by far the greatest clash of spiritual titans in this period that we've looked at in the Roman Catholic Church. And Bossuet had decided that during this period, after he thought things had set down and settled down with the condemnation of Guyon's teachings, he began to settle on really what his main heart was. His primary heart was pastoral teaching and preaching within the church. And so he wrote this work on pastoral instruction and how pastors are to instruct their church on how to pray. So he sends a copy to Fenelon, who is an archbishop at this time, in order to have his work read over, edited, and approved by a leading figure in the church. Ultimately, Fenelon would not approve the work because of how condemning Bossuet was of Guyon's teachings. And so Fenelon decides, no, I won't approve it to be published. And so here it was. Bossuet now has to find another person to try and approve his work to be published. But instead of that, what really Fenelon was trying to do was to postpone Bossuet's work from actually being published so that he could write a work supporting Guyon's teaching on prayer. So while Bossuet's book was being postponed because of the actions of Fenelon, Fenelon wrote his own book called Explications of the Maxim of the Saints Concerning the Interior Life, which supported the Guyon's teachings of quietism. And he had his book published 1 month before Bossuet's was, because he had it purposely postponed so that he could basically beat Bossuet to the punch, who was trying to condemn Guyon's teachings. He wanted to protect those. And this caused Bossuet, obviously, to be extremely angry. And he decided, okay, that's what you want to do. He had decided he was going to launch an all-out attack on Fenelon. And so for the next 2.5 years, there was a pamphlet war, because there wasn't social media or Twitter, so they just lost a pamphlet war against each other, going back and forth, condemning the teachings of one another. The fact that the two leading bishops of France were arguing over principles of love and hope caused many of the growing rationalist party, men like Voltaire and others, who very just much despised religion at this point, it caused them to just begin and laugh and create satires over the fact that the two greatest bishops in France were arguing over what love looks like and what hope looks like. And so they started writing satires because they were just done with religion at this point. They were tired of the wars and they were tired of the inward squawkings. And so this really added fuel to the fire of the rationalists like Descartes and Voltaire and David Hume in Scotland and these other rationalists we will look at in some upcoming lectures. They wrote in one of their satires, "Two bishops of France fiercely wrangled in quest of the truth so entangled. Hope's lost in your scheme, love's gone it would seem. Alas, it was faith that got mangled." And so this was the idea. They think faith is really, it's just imploding. Faith is killing itself. Christians are destroying themselves. And that would be the prognosis that Friedrich Nietzsche will get down the road. He will say Christianity killed itself. No one else did it. Christians did it. And these early rationalists are saying that same thing. Bossuet ultimately decided to appeal to the King of France, and the King put pressure on the Pope, and it led to the condemnation of Fenelon, and the Archbishop submitted unreservedly. Fenelon did not want to lose his archbishopric. He did not want to lose his standing in the church. So ultimately, once the King put pressure on him and the Pope not wanting to cause more strife between the kings and the papacy at this point. They all put pressure on Fenelon, and Fenelon submitted, recanted unreservedly. But once again, Fenelon was extremely influential, but not amongst Roman Catholics, primarily amongst Protestant circles, namely the Wesleyans, led by Wesley. You will see very much some of these inner spiritual ideas and concepts within Wesleyan Methodism as we look at that a little bit later on. Now shifting our focus from the mystics of Catholicism during this period, we now turn our attention to Roman Catholic missions. And we've seen already the Roman Catholic missions to the Americas, and now we focus on what they were doing to the east, in places like India and Japan and ultimately China. The huge missionary growth of Roman Catholicism beyond Europe had begun during the 16th century. Roman Catholics had made it into the Americas, the Philippines, India, Malaysia, Malacca, and Japan. I mean, they were just spreading all over the world, and it was something that Protestants would not even come close to catching up with until the rise of William Carey and the modern mission movements in the 19th century. Early on, most Catholic missionary endeavors piggybacked on the colonial expansion of the Spanish and Portuguese empires. So wherever the empires are going to do colonial work, we're just going to jump on the ship and try to get some religious guys in there as well. However, in the 17th century, Catholicism did something very important. It centralized its focus on world missions. So in rather saying, okay, just send a few priests with the conquering and colonialists, let's actually make missions a central thing, and let's send mission teams to the world, divorced from fighters and troops and wars and colonial conquerors. This was led by Pope Gregory XV, and he had ultimately wrote up what he called the Sacred Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith in 1622, which was entrusted with the supervision of Catholic world missions. This was really the first major mission agency within Christianity, was the supervision of the Catholic world missions. This caused some conflict between the Pope and Catholic kings because they believed the Pope was now kind of interfering with their colonial enterprises. The kings just want to get territory. That's all they care about. And they don't like that the Pope's trying to kind of do his own thing within their territories now. They don't like that. And with the growing anger and frustration between the papacy and national kings, this isn't really helping things. However, there was one person who really held it together, and that was the first secretary of this propagation of the faith, and that was a man by the name of Francesco Ingeli. Now, he turned out to be probably one of the greatest missionary directors in church history. Ingeli's guidelines for Catholic missions became decisive for the future. He argued that missions must be uncoupled from colonial power. The Pope must create more bishops to govern the newly established missions, and that indigenous priests were to be trained as swiftly as possible. For the first time ever, the idea of actually training up indigenous-led groups, indigenous-led churches and authorities, starts to become a very common idea. The kings despised this and said that they had the right to appoint bishops, not the Pope. And so the Pope decides to kind of weasel his way around it by creating a new position that's never been heard of in church history. He calls it the Vicar's Apostolic position. Now, what this was is that they were bishops in everything but title. So he created a new position so that he could skirt underneath the kings who said they had the right to appoint bishops. And so they said, well, we'll just create a new position so that you have no authority over it, in order to oversee these newly evangelized people groups. The Society of Foreign Missions was soon set up in France, and right after, a seminary was created, which was the foremost training center for Catholic missions during this period. As the Spanish and Portuguese empires were soon sinking into decline, in which they were very rapidly moving into the late 17th century, a new empire began to rise in importance, and that was the French Empire. And two important focuses during this period of Catholic missions that we really need to kind of put our attention on. The first is the missionary by the name of Robert de Nobili. And we will look ultimately at the Chinese rites controversy and the rise of the Chinese inland mission for Roman Catholicism. But the first I want us to look at is Robert Day Mabili. Now, you may say, well, that looks like Gandhi or, you know, a Hindu scholar. Well, this is the first person really in church history to practice what we call missional contextualization. And the idea is I'm going to become one of them in order to win them to Christ. I'm not going to look like a European, or I'm not going to eat like a European, or I'm not going to act like a European. I will become in every way of their culture and use their teachings and their culture to ultimately turn them to Christ. And that really becomes a huge staple in missionary methods from this point forward. Now, Billy had trained with the Jesuits who sent him to India on missions, arriving in 1605. He mastered the Tamil languages within months and was assigned to Madurai, which was the capital of the Tamil culture. A mission had already been established there, but it was not very successful at all. And Nobili disagreed with most of the methods, because at this point, the missional method was this: full assimilation. You are going to look like a European, or you're going to dress like one. All of the cultural distinctives that you have as a group will be taken away. In order to be Christian, you must be European. And that was the mindset during this period. And Nobili radically disagreed with that. He decided to pay the most attention on the Brahmin caste of the Indian culture. Now, the Brahmins are the highest caste in Hindu culture. They are the highest caste group. And so these usually are the priests within Hinduism. He decided to focus primarily on them because if he could bring salvation to the highest caste, it would naturally trickle down into the lower caste in this caste system of Hinduism. To do this, Nobili studied their text and their culture, and he virtually became a Christian Brahmin, a Christian priest. He looked like a Hindu priest, a Hindu Brahmin, but he was teaching Christian doctrine, utilizing their language in order to teach Christian principles. He now went about with a shaven head. He wore the robe of a sannyasi, which is what we see there. A sannyasi is kind of the clerical garb for the Hindu Brahmins. And he ate a strict vegetarian diet, because we know about reincarnation. You don't want to eat the good things, you know. You don't want to eat a cow. That'll make a lot of people angry. So he ate strict vegetarianism, and this was all to just try and prevent a stumbling block from doing evangelism. He did not want to be seen as one pushing a European way of life. He wanted to be seen as a teacher of universal truth. The higher caste were astounded by Nobili's teaching, and they could clearly grasp Christianity when he dressed it in an Indian garb. So he basically took their stories and their teachings and applied Christian doctrine into their stories and into their ideas. He explained theology, illustrating his points from classic Indian literature. And within 4 years, Nobili had won 63 converts from the higher caste system. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but considering this, the prior mission had only seen about 4 converts during that time, from about a decade. And so this is an extreme change. However, he soon came under attack from both the native Indians and his Catholic superiors. The Indians believed that Nobili, no matter how much he tried to dress like one of them, could never divorce himself from his European roots. So no matter how much you want to eat like us and look like us, you're still a European. And his superiors in the Catholic Church believed that he was blending Christianity and Hinduism far too much. And in doing so, he was creating his own church, which was separate from Catholicism. Nobili addressed these charges in a very important work, which is extremely long. This is the title: Reply to the Objections Raised Against the Method Used in the New Mission of Madurai for the Conversion of Gentiles to Christ. This was his dissertation title, basically. And ultimately, Nobili was exonerated. He argued his case extremely well, and the Catholic Church was not able to find anything wrong with his teachings. And in 1623, he was able to continue his work, which now, having been successful among the Brahmin caste, he began doing work amongst the lower caste within the Indian culture. By this time, however, Nobili had grown very sick and ultimately blind. He became blind near the end of his life, and he died. But he had cemented a place in the history of Christian missions. And that brings us to our final topic, and that was the Chinese Rite's controversy. Now, Nabili's methods do not hold a candle to how contentious the controversy was that erupted over the Jesuit missionary practices in China. Francis Xavier had reached the Chinese islands of Shangtuan, where he died in 1552, and other Jesuits immediately began following him, as a lot of the coastal areas of China had been under Portuguese protection. So many of these Jesuit missionaries were able to get into the coastlands fairly easy because of the Portuguese protection that they had. But soon they began to pierce mainland China. And the first great Catholic missionary in mainland China was a man by the name of Mateo Ricci, who produced a Portuguese-Chinese dictionary and was the first major European scholar of Chinese culture and studies. 1601, Ricci gained access to Peking or Beijing, the capital of the Chinese Empire. And the emperor invited Ricci to his capital primarily because of one interesting fact: Ricci's astronomical skills. You see, the Jesuits were incredible scientists, perhaps the greatest scientist in the world during this period. And their astronomy was just elite. I mean, it was incredible at this point. And they were able to do things like predicting solar eclipses, which were extremely valuable to Chinese culture. Here, the emperor had a person who could tell him when solar eclipses would happen, when great astronomical features would occur in the sky. And for them, especially a culture that is driven by things like zodiacs and calendars and signs and stars and astronomy, this was a huge thing for them and really got Ricci an in with the Chinese emperor. Ricci was the first Westerner ever allowed into the Chinese capital of Beijing. At this point, no Westerner was allowed into Beijing because of the fact that they believed that it was a special sacred city, and any Western influence would pollute the sacred nature of Beijing. Ultimately, because of the favor that Ricci had gained with the emperor, he remained in Beijing for the rest of his life until 1610. He established a Catholic congregation in the city where converts were coming from both the most high and the most educated of Chinese culture. However, controversy soon followed Ricci, who in studying Confucianism, which was the primary theology or teaching, if you want to say that, or religious practice in China, was Confucianism. He chose to use controversial translations regarding the title of God. He used titles that were found in Confucianism in order to use them and transfer them over pertaining to titles of God. And this got him in a lot of hot water with Roman Catholicism. He said that God could be called Tin Chu, or which was meant Lord of Heaven, or even the more contentious Sheng Ti, which means Sovereign Lord. Now, that may not sound like anything bad, but because he is the Sovereign Lord, he is Lord of Heaven. The problem is that in Confucianism, that same language was being utilized for Confucius. It was being utilized as someone who just meant worthy, set apart, righteous. And so many Catholics were very worried that people would see like Jesus and Confucius as equals. And this was a dangerous thing that they were very fearful of. The issue with these is that they were commonly used to describe not only Confucius, but impersonal realities, like ultimate being. So we're not talking about a personal God. We're just talking about a being who exists in the sky, kind of a platonic, the supreme one, right? There's just the supreme being there, but he's impersonal and he does not interact with his creation. That was the ideas behind many of these words that were used in Confucianism. And so many Catholics were not liking the words and the choices that Ricci was using to try to describe God, the triune God of Scripture, with Confucian teaching and Confucian language. Even more problematic was the ceremonies of veneration that Confucianism required Chinese families to pay to their ancestors. So if you've ever seen the movie Mulan, the Disney movie, he comes out, he prays to his ancestors, offers incense to his ancestors. Very common veneration in Confucianism. Now, the issue was this pagan idolatry, or did it lack religious dimension? So, was this pagan idolatry, or was it not religious at all and merely a family tradition? Ricci obviously argued that it wasn't worship, they weren't worshiping their family, it wasn't idolatry, that they were simply practicing family customs and traditions, and so it shouldn't be frowned upon. Now, I have a personal estimation of, I don't see how any Roman Catholic could condemn the veneration of ancestors when they do the veneration of saints. And so I don't see what much the difference is, except I guess you could say the church has the right to define who's a saint and who isn't. And that would be about the only standard apart from that. So Ricci allowed his converts to continue with these practices because he did not see them as wrong. And all the Jesuits who followed in his steps adopted these policies. This led to remarkable success of conversions among Confucianists because in every way they got to maintain their culture and just kind of replace Confucius with Jesus. And that was really what they did. So for them, it didn't seem like much of a difference at all. And by the end of the 17th century, conservative estimates say that there were thousands of Christian converts from a high-class Confucian background. The Chinese Emperor Kangxi was so impressed by the respectful attitude of the Jesuits to Chinese culture and their contributions that it led to an edict of toleration for them in 1692. So the Chinese emperor is saying they have full toleration to practice their Christian faith here in China. However, unfortunately for the Jesuits, they were not the only Catholic missionaries doing work in China. There was these other groups, which I like to call denominations just to make my fellow Catholic friends angry, the Dominicans and the Franciscans, who were also doing work in China, who did not agree with the Jesuits. The Dominicans and the Franciscans believed that if you want to be Christian, you better throw away all of that old religion, all of that old thinking, and you're going to start where we are, and that is European religion. That's what it's going to look like. And if it doesn't look like that, it's pagan, it's wrong, and it's bad. And so they rejected the Jesuit approach, and they said that the Jesuits were selling out the gospel to paganism. That's what their argument was. And the Pope at that time finally said, you're right, it doesn't look good what they're doing. I mean, they are just capitulating almost everything. They're just taking terms and just putting Jesus there. That's the only difference. And so the Pope ultimately sided against the Jesuits and with the Dominicans and Franciscans, and he sent an ambassador to the Emperor of China saying that the Confucian Christians had to denounce all Confucianism and culture. And this angered the Chinese emperor, who had been told by men like Matteo Ricci that they would be able to maintain their Confucianism and the culture therein. In 1721, the emperor was so angered by this idea that the Christians there would have to become, in many ways, what he considered European, quasi-European, that he banished all Christian missionaries from China. I don't want you here at all. So every Catholic group, every Christian missionary was banned from China, and Catholic missions would really never recover in China. And really, I would say Christian missions would really not even have a glimmer of hope in China until Hudson Taylor begins the Chinese inland mission in the 19th century. And we'll look at that when we get to him. But all of this touches on two very important things that have been a debate amongst missionary methods to this day. The first is contextualization. To what extent can the Christian missionary follow Paul in 1 Corinthians 9:22 when he says that we are to be all things to all men? What does he mean by that? Like, to what extent is the line? Like, how much do we give? How much do we allow culture to maintain? Where do we stop? What is wrong in a culture? If you go into a culture the first time, a new tribal group, per se, you've gone into Africa as a missionary for the first time, you're coming and you're preaching the gospel, you're teaching the truths of the scripture, but you're coming into a culture that for years and years has praised polygamy. And a tribal leader has eight wives. Should you tell him that he now has to divorce seven of them and allow them to go off into their own? Or does the church take care of them? What is the answer to that? This has boggled lots of missionaries' minds. And that has been an issue forever. And our job tonight is not to answer those questions, but it is simply to show how this argument has become centerfold to most missions in the world today. What does proper biblical contextualization look like, and what is going too far? Secondly, the question became, who actually has the primary authority to develop a Christian mission methodology? Is it the missionaries on the ground, or is it the mission agency that's sending them? Who determines the practice utilized by that missionary? And so at some point, that missionary is going to have to make decisions. And the question is, does he have authority to? Does he have authority on ground to say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to adopt this, I'm going to allow for that practice, while at the same time never undermining the essential realities of the Christian message? That is, should he have that right, or should his sending church or agency have that right? That becomes another question. And all of these things that we're seeing here become a mindset. You can even see in the picture of Ricci, where he's wearing the traditional Chinese garb in this picture. They grow their beard out. When we look at pictures of Hudson Taylor, they'll all have the little Chinese hat on, and they'll have their heads shaved a certain way, and that's what they do. So we have to ask ourselves, at what point is contextualization okay? What is it? Who has the authority to determine when a method is right and when it isn't? And these are all things that would continue to be a part of the discussion regarding mission methodology, even to this day. So that's where we're going to end our lecture tonight. But before I do, I just want to show you this last picture here. It's a really neat picture. So here you have kind of the three major Jesuit leaders there in China. You have Matthew Ricci on the left. You have Adam Schall in the middle. And then Ferdinand Verdius on the right there. Now, the reason why I wanted to show this picture is because look at all like the scientific gadgets they have around them. You know, you have the globe here, which goes to show you that they were already realizing it wasn't a flat earth or anything like that. And they were using many of these astronomical tools and things like that. Many of them were already creating these kind of tablets and things like that that were kind of like pre-electronic calculators and things like that that could do quick arithmetic and math. And so the Jesuits in many ways, and this is so important, that the vast majority of science done from the 15th century in the Renaissance all the way up until, you could say, the late 18th century into the 19th century, were all Christian scientists. Science was pushed and developed by Christianity and was a big part of that. And so I just find that fascinating. If you look at a lot of these pictures and drawings of the missionaries during this period, it's very common to see them with all of these mathematical, scientific scales and devices that were very key to the scientific developments at this point. So I just think that's really cool, especially when we look in a couple weeks at the rationalist party and the rationalist group, who will say that Christianity is science denier. It rejects reason and rationality. And so we will talk about that when we get there. Next week, we will look at Eastern Orthodoxy and the developments happening there in the 17th and 18th century. And following the next week, we will look at the rationalist. So let's close there tonight and pray. Father God, we thank you so much for the ability we have to study together. And God, we just, if there's anything with all of the confusion as it pertains to missions and things like that, God, we know one thing, and that is we are to be a missionary people. So we just ask that you give us discernment and wisdom when it pertains to those issues of contextualization. God, that we would be able to have a clear understanding of what is essential and what isn't. And that you would just give us wisdom in those areas, because they are tough areas to navigate. And Lord, so we just ask that you would lead us with your Spirit when it comes to that, especially as we had the opportunity and blessing to send missionaries out this morning. God, we ask that you would just be with everyone this week, that you would just bless them and keep them safe, protect them, and bring them back next Sunday, Lord willing. We just look forward to seeing them all there, God. So we just thank you, we praise you, and we just say all of these things in the name of Christ. Amen.